Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com. Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
It's a California Report magazine. I'm Sasha Coca. Today, we're revisiting two of our favorite stories from this year, featuring families and food. We'll start by heading to Del Rey. It's a little farming community about 20 miles south of Fresno. David Masamoto, everybody calls him Moss, drives an old pickup past rows and rows of fruit trees that are exploding with blossoms.
We're in the Spring Lady Peaches.
This is a multi-generational family farm. His dad bought it in the late 40s.
Six rows of nectarines that bloomed a little earlier.
Moss's daughter is taking over operations, and there's a new grandbaby who will grow up playing in these orchards.
And then back here are four rows of apricots.
Food lovers come from all over the state to pick their own Masamoto peaches and nectarines, including reporter Lisa Morehouse. And she knows Moss's work as an author, too. In his latest book called Secret Harvests, Moss writes about the shock of a newly uncovered family secret. So Lisa went back to the Masamoto farm for her series, California Foodways. She wanted to learn about Moss's discovery and about just how resilient his farming family is.
Moss Masamoto says he farms with ghosts.
So these trees are like an old growth forest. They're 60 years old, and no one keeps an orchard for 60 years, but they're still producing wonderfully.
When he walks these rows of sun-crest peaches, the spirit of his father is by his side.
When you plant something with someone, and in this case with my father, literally our fingerprints are on this.
He points out cuts made 10 and 20 years ago by farm workers and his father, his daughter, and himself.
And yet new growth, and this is what I love about this, new growth is coming to fill it.
A teenaged Moss helped his dad plant these trees, reluctantly.
I didn't want to be out in the field planting, and my dad was being methodical, planting one by one in a row. I was rushing.
Look down the row, and you can see some trees aren't lined up, and some are leaning over. He was more interested in playing electric guitar. Moss was the third kid, a renegade, a misfit. He couldn't wait to leave the farm. He remembers one day during his senior year of high school.
I applied for college, got in. I was a bad guitarist, but I was playing a Led Zeppelin song. It was a whole lot of love. My dad comes in and says, hey, can you do this work? And I said, sure, but you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, I'm never coming back to the farm. Da-da-da-da-da-da. And I probably broke his heart, and he just said, okay.
He went off to UC Berkeley, then studied in Japan, where he ended up in the country where his ancestors farmed rice.
I was there working the rice fields.
With his great uncle.
Pulling this wooden cart through these ancient rice fields. And I go, I don't have a clue how to grow rice. And I realized I love the countryside, but, you know, maybe I should come back to peaches and nectarines because I understand it. I know the rhythms of it, plus the cultural rhythms that come with it.
Cultural rhythms of family and history in the Central Valley. He came back permanently over 40 years ago. And he thought he knew all of that family history until one day in 2012. Moss got a phone message from a funeral home.
And I thought it was they wanted me to buy a early package before I passed away. And I go, what is this?
But he talked to one of the owners.
And this wonderful woman named Renee, she said, I want to let you know that your mom's sister, Shizuko, is in a hospice program.
Renee's funeral home had received a contract to bury Shizuko's remains when she died.
And I said, what are you talking about? This isn't my aunt. I know all my family.
Even though it had nothing to do with her job at the funeral home, Renee wanted to find a living relative for Shizuko and had scoured census records as far back as 1930 and cross-referenced them with obituaries. She showed it all to Moss when they met.
And I go, yeah, that's the Sugimoto family. There's my uncles, there's my aunts, there's Shizuko, and there's my mom.
Shizuko had suffered a stroke and was in a nursing home just a few miles from Moss's farm. She'd been in Fresno since the 1970s, literally living down the road for more than 40 years. But Moss had never heard of her. Renee told him,
you know, I just want to make sure she doesn't die alone.
Moss was stunned. But before running to his mom with the news, before sending out emails to the family, he checked medical records and met Shizuko. She was near death, curled up in bed. All he could do was hold her hand.
And something about holding her hand made me feel she's real.
He sat down with his mom.
And I said, you remember an Aunt Shizuko? She goes, oh yeah, she passed away. And I said, take a deep breath, Mom. She's alive in Fresno. And there was silence. There was silence.
Ma says he could see a rush of simultaneous emotions cross his mother's face. Guilt, shame, loss, and joy. The next day, she was ready to reunite with her sister. And in the following days, other family members came too. They sat at Shizuko's bedside, talking and reminiscing. Moss asked them to tell him more about his aunt.
No one knows the whole story or is willing to tell you the whole story. You know, so everybody told me slightly different parts of it.
Moss started to piece together Shizuko's timeline with the family history he already knew. Shizuko was born just south of Fresno in 1919 to a family with a long history of farming.
Both of my grandfathers were second sons. They weren't going to inherit the rice field in Japan.
In the early 1900s, they came to California, to the Central Valley. His grandmothers were picture brides, single women who married men in America, matched only by photographs.
And they were farm workers, and that's an important distinction.
They were forced to work on other men's farms for low wages. Racist laws kept them from owning property and applying for citizenship. Shizuko was a typical farm girl playing in the fields.
Realized the family was poor. They didn't have childcare. You would take kids out into the fields with you. I know that because I did that growing up.
When she was 5 years old, Shizuko got very sick with what the family later learned was meningitis. They didn't take her to a doctor.
And I kept thinking, how come they didn't get medical care? But then you stop and think, oh, wait a minute. They were poor. They lived in a rural area. They didn't speak English. They were immigrants.
They were Buddhists, and many hospitals were Christian.
There was no health care for them.
When she came out of her fever, Shizuko had lost most of her speech. Masa's relatives told him she stopped growing intellectually.
I know she never went to school. Because there weren't special ed programs back then. So they tried to take care of her best they could through the Great Depression.
But they couldn't always keep her safe. Now, Moss's mom and her siblings did tell him a lot about their sister, but some of their memories were hazy, and some were just too painful to talk much about. One story Moss could only piece together from fragments they told him. Shizuko was a teenager, home alone, maybe while her family was working in the fields. When they came home, her clothes were torn.
Obviously, Shizuko was upset. My aunt said, there were bad neighbor boys. And after what they did to Shizuko, my grandmother cut her hair off so she'd look like a boy.
Hoping this might protect her daughter when she couldn't. Moss doesn't want Shizuko remembered for this assault, for one of the worst moments of her life. He likes to imagine her in a place she could wander freely and dance, the family garden.
My grandfather was a carpenter, and he made these intricate wooden pagodas and buildings in this little miniature garden.
Shizuko would spend hours there.
My mom used the word, she'd be lost in the garden. And I loved that idea. She would be lost. And that's where she found comfort, I think.
When Moss works on the farm, he thinks about his grandfather's garden and about tankobushi, a song and dance performed at a festival to honor ancestors.
It's like a folk dance, a folk song, and it was about coal mining.
With dancers moving as if they carried shovels, Japanese immigrants brought tankobushi to their farming communities. Moss demonstrates dipping, turning, and reaching.
So when the music cues up, you would move forward and shovel, 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 stop, pick it up, toss, toss, turn, turn, push, push.
And Moss likes to imagine Shizuko wandering around the miniature pagodas in her father's garden, moving like the dancers she'd seen. Shovel, shovel, toss, toss. But after the bombing of Pearl Harbor in December 1941, Moss's dad removed the pagodas. Shizuko stopped wandering in the garden. The family was exiled from home.
More than 100,000 men, women, and children, all of Japanese ancestry, removed from their homes in the Pacific Coast states to wartime communities established in out-of-the-way places.
The government hastily built prison camps and forced people with Japanese ancestry to move into them. Moss's family was assigned to Gila River in Arizona.
The entire community, bounded by a wire fence and guarded by military police, symbols of the military nature of the evacuation.
The family had no idea how long they'd be at Gila River, what the conditions were, and if there would be any way for them to care for someone with special needs.
They had no options. It was a crazy, chaotic time.
So in desperation, they contacted the local sheriff, asking if the state would take care of Shizuko.
And the scene that I was told was that my aunt Shizuko was holding my grandmother, her mom. The sheriff came and pulled them apart, and my aunt realized she's been taken away and started, she couldn't talk much, but she could say a few words, and she was saying, "Mama, mama."
The sheriff put Shizuko in the car and promised she would be cared for. This is when Shizuko and her family began living parallel lives. Shizuko became a ward of the state, and the rest of the Sugimoto family left for Gila River, where they would be imprisoned for more than 3 years. In 1945, when they returned to the Central Valley from prison camp, the Sugimotos were worse off than ever. They were still farm workers, owning nothing, scraping by as laborers for other people, struggling to survive. But Shizuko's mother and eldest brother searched for her.
They locate Shizuko in a mental hospital, in one of those big ones that had thousands of patients, saw her. And the word was that they said at least she's been fed, she's been taken care of. So maybe she's better off there because we can't take care of her because we're struggling just to feed ourselves.
The family never spoke of it again. In the late 40s, Moss's dad cobbled together enough money to buy the first acres of this farm.
When you hear the shovel go down into the dirt, you could hear this. And you go, oh, crap.
That's hardpan, mineralized soil that's a nightmare for farmers. Moss's dad spent years cleaning out the hardpan on this land, sometimes with dynamite, so he could plant trees.
Thud. It's the thud of reality. It's in amazing ways the thud of history, right? You got this land because no one else wanted it. So this is the reality. This is the sound of being poor farmer.
While the rest of Masa's family struggled to put down roots in the Central Valley, Shizuko was without family. She was a ward of the state in institutions. But Moss imagines there might have been moments of connection across time and space between Shizuko and her mother. The Sugimotos did a lot of work with raisins during the blistering hot late summer.
One thing about raisins, you could work off the farm during the day and in the evening take care of your own farm. right? You got two incomes that way. That's how you survived.
They'd pick grapes and dry them on paper trays between the vines. When the grapes turned into perfect raisins, each paper tray was rolled up and collected from the field.
And on a full moon, you can work at night. I know my grandmother worked late, rolling trays late at night.
He imagines a moment when she paused and looked into the night sky, and Shizuko did too.
Could they have been at the one moment under the same moon?
When Moss met Shizuko in 2012, she was comatose. But her caregivers told him what she was like before the stroke.
They actually would say, "We love Miss Sugi."
Short for Sugimoto.
Oh, she's so full of life.
She'd sneak up on someone, pinch them lightly, and run away, giggling. Shizuko wandered the care home halls so much that the staff got her those tennis shoes that light up.
She'd put on those tennis shoes and walk up and down the hall and watch the lights go sparkling as she ran up and down and ran back, and she would do that for hours.
Caregivers also talked about Shizuko's morning ritual.
She loved hot coffee in the morning. And when she was finished with her cup, she would throw the cup over her shoulder. So they quickly realized that they had to switch cups from a glass cup or a plastic cup to a styrofoam cup.
And they moved her seat so that her back was to a wall and her cup would hit that, not another person.
That was her trademark. She was carefree, free enough to do that.
All this time, as Moss was listening to his family's stories, building an image in his mind of the woman his aunt had become, she remained in a coma.
We thought she was going to pass within weeks. She was in hospice. The doctors that I saw and nurses, the nursing staff at the assisted care center, all thought she would die. The caregivers said, we'll see.
Ma says these caregivers, who called his aunt Miss Sugi, dressed her in lighted tennies, and delighted in her playful pinches, kept her alive.
They figured out a way of feeding her, not intravenously, not through a tube. They figured out a way where they could tickle her, and she would kind of stir from her comatose state. They would give her a liquid diet. They did this for 3 months.
And then Moss got another surprising phone call.
"Hey, you know your aunt? She's up." I said, "What? Yeah, she woke up. You should come visit her."
When Moss arrived at the home, one protective caregiver asked who he was.
And I said, "Well, I'm her nephew. I'm her family." And he looked at me and he goes, "Where have you been all these years?" And it just hit me right here because he was right. And it made me realize they were her family.
And when he came face to face with Shizuko?
I wanted this kind of this image you see in a movie or something where she looks at me, I look at her, we start crying and we hug each other. No, she didn't know who I was. And then she kicks me. She kicks me. And I go, "What?" And I looked and I realized she wanted her shoe tied.
It dawned on him, getting attention when she needed something, that was one way Shizuko survived 70 years in institutions.
And it was the perfect way to be reintroduced to Shizuko and her story. This is how family secrets are. They kind of kick you. And that's how you sort of say, "Oh, I think I need to pay attention to this."
Over the next many months, Moss walked alongside Shizuko, who now roamed the halls in a wheelchair. Sometimes she allowed him to help her around people who blocked her path.
You know, she didn't kick me anymore, you know. She would touch my face, you know, which I thought was a sign that I was something to her.
At first, Ma says he struggled to tell the story without being angry.
You know, angry at, you know, decisions that were made, angry at alien land laws, angry at internment.
But the more he learned, the more people he met who knew Shizuko, the more his family told stories about her, the focus of his emotions changed.
I began to realize, no, this family secret isn't depressing. It's about life. She's alive and presto. She's part of this family coming back together. It's really about like a family reunion with the past in the present.
When Shizuko died in the summer of 2013, at age 93, the family was able to place her ashes with the rest of the Sugimotos.
This one might be rooted a little deeper.
We're in a row of spring lady peaches that Moss planted in 1985 when his daughter was born. He's going to plant a new tree, but first he's removing parts of an old stump that's rotted out.
The old tree has been pulled out. It's giving up its space. It's time for this tree to move on, and then we'd plant a new tree in this spot.
Neat. Because the tree was so old and because there was so much decay, you don't need to remove all of it to plant this new guy.
Seems to me that the wood would just decompose and actually feed it, and it would also create a more porous structure. So you want water to penetrate where the roots are. You know, and then there is this theory, right, about how trees and plants talk to each other. You know, would the new roots say, oh, I'm in this comfort zone of one of my ancestors?
Or does the old decaying tree just make the perfect soil for the new one?
And I would like to think it's both.
Moss does find comfort in the company of his ancestors. Aunt Shizuko's now in his pantheon of ghosts, another resilient ancestor helping on the farm. Moss says he thinks about Shizuko when he's walking rows of peaches in bloom, when his shovel hits hard pan, when he's rolling paper trays of raisins. He farms with her spirit now. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Delray.
And now we're going to meet a chef in Oakland who opened a restaurant celebrating Native American cuisine. This summer, KQED's Bianca Taylor brought us the story of Wapepa's Kitchen as part of our series, Flavor Profile.
It's a busy Friday morning at Wapepa's Kitchen. A team of people is chopping green jalapenos into coins, rinsing pinto beans in a large pot, and removing seeds from dried red chilies to blend with maple syrup and olive oil.
This goes for the fried bread tacos. It goes ground rice, beans. She just made the salsa, and it comes cheese, lettuce. And so this is what we added on the menu last week.
That's Chef Crystal Wapepa. She's wearing a black T-shirt and red beaded earrings in the shape of small strawberries. She's moving around the industrial kitchen like a conductor, directing, observing, praising. It makes sense that she feels so at home here.
I always wanted to be an indigenous chef, pretty much like at a very young age, because I really, really loved cooking and I have that connection when it comes to the soil, to the land.
Like her mother and grandfather, Crystal is a member of the Kickapoo tribe of Oklahoma. Her first memories of cooking indigenous foods are making fry bread with her auntie and grandmother when she was just 7 years old. But growing up in Oakland on Ohlone land, surrounded by diverse neighbors and food from all over the world, Crystal was struck by how there were no Native restaurants. This was decades before Berkeley's Cafe Ohlone. She wanted to change that. She graduated from the prestigious Cordon Bleu Culinary School, and in 2010 opened one of the first Native American woman-owned catering businesses in California.
I'm in San Francisco, in the tech world, literally going out of my Native community, serving these foods no one's never heard of, so I had all the questions brought at me, you know, up to, oh yeah, this is Native American land, huh?
At the beginning of 2020, she had just started selling her indigenous snack bars online, treats made with wild rice, amaranth, pepita, and cranberries, when COVID hit. Then she found out the kitchen where she ran her catering business was closing. So she reached out to her community to see if anyone had a kitchen space she could share. But a few months later, a friend came back with a different, bigger proposal, an entire restaurant in Oakland's Fruitvale Station.
When you have a restaurant, this is who you are. This is your personality. This is your heart and your soul, your hard labor.
Remember, this was at a time when the Bay Area had some of the strictest COVID restrictions around indoor dining. And even if people could go out to eat, a lot of us were too scared to do so. Opening a restaurant during a pandemic was a huge financial risk.
We have a huge Native community here in the Bay Area. I feel like this is a space that needs to be represented, needs to be seen within our community. I said, okay, let's do it.
So she opened Wapepa's Kitchen in November 2021. The community response assured Crystal she had done the right thing.
There was dancing, drums, music, celebration. I can still tear up to this day. I was so like, wow, our time has come. Our mission is to say, one, we're here. At the same time, I want people to come here and have that home away from home to eat different kind of foods from different tribes.
The menus at Wapiapa's Kitchen are written in the Kickapoo language with English translations. Starters include taquitos hand-rolled with smoked hibiscus and a mixture of sweet and white potatoes. You can order a side of deer sticks with a chokecherry dipping sauce. All the ingredients Crystal uses come directly from native food producers.
Our blue corn comes from the Northern Ute Nation. Our bison comes from the Cheyenne River. The beans come from the Pima Maricopa Nation. Our maple comes from the Ottawa. This is something that they have been reclaiming and reviving and protecting and saving, and we have the honor to serve it on our table.
Central to her mission is acknowledging how colonization violently separated Native American tribes from their foodways.
Different Native American tribes being moved, all of us has the same story of how our foods were lost.
This started with the killing of the buffalo in the 1860s, what President Grant called America's solution to the country's quote-unquote Indian problem. One U.S. Army member is said to have told his troops, every buffalo dead is an Indian gone. The policy of violent separation continued in the 1950s, when the Indian Relocation Act forced Native people to leave their reservations and move to the cities. We still see the connected battle over Native food and land sovereignty today, like the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, which the tribe says would poison their drinking water.
And a lot of people are lost from this land just because of historical trauma had taken place. And I think it's very, very important where everybody must come to a Native American restaurant and get educated.
It starts in the kitchen with the staff, who represent 17 different tribes. This includes Crystal's three daughters, who are members of the Big Valley Rancheria Pomo tribe.
I just want people to come here and be in the space and to can relate to the foods. And this is where we connect.
In addition to running Wapiapa's Kitchen, Crystal is working on a cookbook, which makes all of this a seven-day-a-week labor of love. Because when she's doing this work, she feels reconnected to her family.
My grandmother, oh, she would love it. She might not be here physically, but she's here. When we go into the fall season time, you'll see a fry bread on the side or even cornbread. It's her. She's here.
For the California Report, I'm Bianca Taylor in Oakland.
And that's it for the California Report magazine for this week. Our interim senior editor is Katrina Schwartz. Susie Racho is our director producer. Our engineer is Brendan Willard. And Olivia Zhao is our intern. I'm Sasha Koga. Thanks so much for listening. This is the California Report magazine. Your state, your stories. Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.